This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
Libby is off preparing for and celebrating Passover. Great to have you here with me. Well, it seems like a never-ending discussion in Toronto. What is the best way to deal with traffic congestion? It seems the root of this question may be more about improving the way construction is carried out. After all, as we learned from a report this week, Toronto is the busiest construction city in North America. Members of Toronto's Infrastructure and Environment Committee have made some decisions, including better timing of construction projects and increasing fees for construction companies taking up lanes of traffic. So is this recipe going to create a better traffic flow? As always, we want you to weigh in, 416-360-0740 or toll free, 1-866-740-4740.
And now, it's time to tune into the town.
Our Tune Into the Town municipal panel is John Burnside, City Councillor for Ward 16, Don Valley East. He is on the phone. Former City Councillor and former mayoral candidate Rob Davis in studio here with me. And Taylor Scollon, also in studio, co-founder of Zoomer Media Property, The Peak. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Hey there.
John, I will start with you, if we've got you hooked up there, and get your thoughts about what was decided at committee, which you're not part of, but you will be when the plan goes to full city council.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, sure, but it seems to be more of the same, coordinating construction projects, absolutely. But, you know, one of the things is there's such a lack of enforcement around these construction projects. So I come along Dundas in the mornings, and there's a construction project off on one of the side streets, but all the trucks are lined up in rush hour on Dundas, and there's practically no enforcement. Our staff need to get on top of that. The other thing is they you know, we can charge more for lane closures, but then that adds to the price of housing. So then you have these competing goals. But I think the ultimate issue, and they say it's the number of construction projects, sure, but when you're adding, I think it was about 26% increase in the number of vehicles registered in the region, you know, you've got a lot more people trying to use fewer roads. So I think it's going to be a lot of more hand-wringing with very few results, and we'll be talking about it 5 years from now.
And is the administration in place, John, to start coordinating these construction ventures at the same time?
Well, one of the, you know, under Mayor Tory, it was supposed to be done then. So I do question that. I think there needs to be more accountability with our staff, as I say, just simply inspecting the sites and making sure that they're not encroaching or that they don't start up closing lanes at 8 in the morning as opposed to 9 when the permit permits. I think it's really not so much about the infrastructure as opposed to the accountability of the various people who are responsible. And until we have that, I don't think it's really going to have much of an impact.
We've been really good talkers about traffic and traffic congestion and all the nightmares that is Toronto. Rob, does this sound to you like an action plan?
No, it's foolishness. It's a fool's errand. Listen, you know, those of us who, you know, had the opportunity of studying a little bit of economics, whether it's in high school or university, we understand the laws of supply and demand. So what did the city do over the last 10 or 15 years? They reduced the supply of road by introducing bike lanes on arterial roads. They increased the demand for the roads by licensing 90,000 Uber drivers, Uber, Lyft drivers, rideshare, call them rideshare. Prior to that, there were only 5,000 licensed taxis in the city plying for business at rush hour. Now there's 90,000 Uber drivers who turn on their app, get in their car, start driving during rush hour, and there's less road. Well, what happens when supply is greater than the demand? The price goes up. What's the price that we pay? Time. Mm-hmm. Time in traffic and congestion. And, you know, this issue of, you know, there's got to be a better coordination. Guess what? They're going to take the ticket. If you've got a $30,000 or $40,000 load of concrete in a dump truck, you'll take the $200 ticket. You've got concrete that's getting ready that needs to be poured, that needs to be set, and you have a lineup of trucks, and you got a building that you're trying to keep on schedule so that people can occupy that building, whether it's a condo or rental or even a commercial or a commercial building.
I guess it depends what the fees are, right? I mean, well, they're not talking about fines. They're talking about fees. So you take up this lane.
Well, there's fees for taking up lanes, like for scaffolding and occupying a lane for a period of time. Well, there could be a penalty for going over the length of the rental, but you know, a lot of builders, they don't control what happens with the supply of concrete, workers, steel. You know, there are some supply chain issues that stop buildings in their tracks until such time as something gets off a boat from South America, from the United States, or from Asia. And they don't control that, right? Yeah. Like, I don't know any builder who wants to take their sweet time to put a building up. So they're already incentivized to go fast. They're trying not to have their carrying costs go overboard. They're trying to reduce their carrying costs. They're trying to get their buildings up so that they can close on the sale of their condos or whatever it is they're building. And so there's already an incentive for them to go fast. The issue is city council is in some ways being hypocritical about how they're doing this. And I think that it starts with what they did with licensing cars for hire. And putting all of that traffic out on the road during rush hour.
All right. Taylor, what are your initial thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, this is a math problem, right? We got a very dense city. We got a lot of people living here and not a lot of road space. I'm sure that there are efficiencies and better coordination that we could do when it comes to construction. I don't think adding more cost to builders who already have a ton of costs and red tape that they have to pay and comply with that's driven up the price of housing, I don't think that's a good solution. And even if we did get the construction, you know, more coordinated, more efficient, they're just going to have more cars on the road after that as soon as it becomes faster to get around. The real solution here is alternatives to driving where people can reliably take the TTC or GO or other public transit to work, to where they need to get to, and not have to worry, oh, the streetcar is out of service, the whole network's down, the subway's not running. We got to get these things functioning in a way that people can count on them to get where they need to go. And then maybe the need to actually drive downtown will be reduced.
Right. So planning, coordinating, that's all important stuff. Having more money come into the coffers of City Hall, that helps all of us, I guess, in one way or another. But just in terms of your personal perspective, Taylor, like, how do you get to work? How do you get to the Zoomerplex every day?
I take the TTC.
You do.
But some days it's fine. And some days it's a mess. You know, today the subway just stopped working halfway to the office. So, okay, now you got to find another way to get down here. And that's the experience for a lot of people. And my commute is not that bad. Some people are coming in from, you know, the edges of the system, taking a bus to get to Warden Station and then taking the subway and then taking another bus. That's another hour and a half of your day, you know, there and back. It's crazy.
Yeah. Not to mention the Gardiner that we are all driving in and adding, depending on the time of day. I was crossing the city yesterday up at Greenwood and Danforth and then heading home to Etobicoke. It would have been around 2. And it was 41 minutes. And I consider that to be very good. Lots of times it'll be the better part of an hour at that time of day as a result of the Gardiner construction.
Exactly. And you know, what's interesting about the suggestion, though, and this is, so it's not just about the time and the cost. So when you're in your vehicle, depending on the type of work that you do, you can also get work done. So a lot of people are, I don't want to say disincentivized, but there's a big incentive to using your vehicle if in the time that you're commuting from home to work, you're able to actually get business done.
Right.
And that's, you know, in part because of smartphones, which we're not supposed to use while driving. But if you have a passenger who's with you, who's part of your, you know, your business enterprise or part of whatever business activities you're involved in, there's a way of doing work, you know, confidentially in your car, that, and you don't get that opportunity. You know, there are still parts of the line where you can't make a phone call, and you probably don't want all 40, 50, 60 people on a train car all on the phone making a business call at the same time. So while it's convenient in a lot of cases to take transit, there's also another benefit to using your own personal vehicle.
Yeah, no, good point. John, back over to you before we switch topics. These recommendations, there are five recommendations that were approved at committee yesterday coming to Toronto City Council. How do you expect that debate and approval process to go down?
Well, I think the committees are handpicked by the mayor, and that's an important one. So I would presume that it will, I think it'll just breeze through council. Everyone will get up and we'll talk about the same things over and over again. Mm-hmm. We'll wring our hands. We'll waste about 4 hours and we'll approve it.
And there won't be much action is what you're saying, at least not in the immediate future. Like in terms of seeing a difference. Yeah.
Well, I'm skeptical that you will see the difference. Yeah. That's the problem, even with what they're doing here, because as I say, there are competing goals. Like if you really want to keep projects from taking up lanes of traffic, you can do that. They do it in London, England all the time, but there's a huge cost that we're then adding to housing. So, you know, those are the competing interests. Do you want people to pay more for their housing, or do we want them to get something a little more affordable and then inconvenience, you know, the rest of Torontonians. And I think that's probably what's ultimately going to happen. They talk about coordinating projects, and that's great, but there are so many projects that just can't be coordinated. When a pipe bursts under the ground or someone does get their approval to build a condo, when it goes through all the various hoops, then you can't really delay them. They have a right to get going, so or not. And so there's so many things we can't control. And right now, as you know, a lot of there are a few condos being put up, but a lot of people are sitting on the sidelines. So they're gonna start building when they want to start building. So the control the city has is a lot is more limited than I think politicians would like people to know.
I think we all kind of feel that. It is our tune into the town municipal panel. We discuss issues around the city and the GTA every Thursday between 12:05 and 12:30. John Burnside, city councillor, former city councillor, Rob Davis, Taylor Scallon, co-founder of The Peak. Okay, let's talk about this bike lane compromise that appears to be in the offing. Rob, I heard this morning from Mike Cole, Deputy Mayor Mike Cole. He was on the morning Zoom with Andy and Jane, our show, and saying that the premier and the mayor are having conversations about being able to keep the controversial bike lanes on Bloor West, University, and Yonge, and reinstate vehicle lanes, that is an actually a doable situation.
It is doable. I want to go back a little bit and start off with the experiment of the bike lane, the one that happened originally back, I guess it would have been 2016 or 2017. And the whole premise around bike lanes being good for the local economy, I think, is really based on bad science and bad investigative journalism on the part of journalists. You know, when they did that first stretch on Bloor Street, College Street was under construction in, I believe, 2016. And College Street is a main east-west artery. And so anyone who would normally drive on College Street then went to Bloor Street. Mm-hmm. Anyone who would normally cycle on College Street then went to Bloor Street. Anyone who would normally shop on College Street then went to Bloor Street. So what they did is they said, oh my gosh, look, we instituted temporary bike lanes, and the ticket price of every sale went up on average because we've got cyclists, which is not really true. And so then the premise for extending bike lanes east and west along Bloor Street was based on that study that didn't take into account the fact that the nearest east-west main street to Bloor Street was under construction. In fact, there was litigation. So now I'm going to go to the premise of your question, which is can we get some active car lanes back? Yes, we can. There are parts of Bloor Street, especially outside of the downtown core in that Etobicoke part, where the street is wide enough that they could have put a two-way bike lane on one side of the street, and I would suggest that probably be the south side of the street, and because evening rush hour is usually much heavier than morning rush hour. People coming into the city tend to have different routes, but people going back from the core of the city back to the suburbs, the traffic is much heavier going westbound than it is going eastbound. They could easily reinstitute another another automobile lane and at the same time keep bike lanes on the south side of the street. In fact, that was a suggestion of my former councillor, John Campbell, when he approached some of the city councillors who completely dismissed him. So I think the reason we're here, we are where we are, is because the council was headstrong in terms of doing it their way. They didn't really want to listen to the concerns of the community. And then the people who had suggestions that said, look, I'm not a big fan of these bike lanes, but here's how you could do it where it'd be more acceptable. They were totally dismissed. So I'm glad to hear that maybe the fact that all of the bike lanes were being threatened means that there's going to be a compromise. That's probably a good thing. But if they don't do it right, then we're going to continue to have traffic chaos.
Let me remind you that phone lines are open. Do you like the idea of a compromise? And I know we talked to a lot of people in Etobicoke on Bloor West between Runnymede and Kipling. I live in that area as well and have talked about being on Bloor West and rarely seeing bikes in the bike lanes. I mean, at this time of year, it's cold, but even in the summer. So what do you think about that? A compromise, would that make everyone happy? 416-360-0740, 1-866-744-740. Is that the right way to go about it, Taylor? Rather than ripping out the bike lanes, let's come up with an engineering solution.
I mean, if you can make it work, I think it's a great solution for these parts of the city. Now, there are certainly some stretches where that's not going to work. You know, closer to where I am, which is more in the annex area along Bloor, we're packed in already. You know, the sidewalks are tight, the bike lanes are tight and very well used, I would say. And the car lanes are tight as well. So I don't know how you get a compromise there. I think everyone's kind of already crammed into their space and I'm not sure there's an engineering solution. I think it would be a mistake to take out the bike lanes in those stretches of the city at least because there's people in them all the time. They're very well used. So I think it depends. It's a case-by-case thing. You know, if you can do it and engineer a solution where we can keep some of the bike infrastructure but have more space for cars as well, I think that's great. What I'm kind of afraid of is that we're going to see situations where they start taking away space from pedestrians and cutting down the side of the sidewalk. Now, I don't think that's been discussed in any of the news articles or the reports yet. But, you know, if you start thinking about, okay, well, where can we take a few inches here and there? You know, maybe the sidewalks start to get narrowed and that wouldn't be so nice. So I, you know, in these situations where they can fit it all in, I think, sure, it's great.
Councillor Burnside, what's going to happen? Do you have any inside information on how they're going to make this all work?
No, I don't. The mayor doesn't talk to me a lot, but, what I will say is that, you know, it really, city council loses so much credibility. And so does city staff when, you know, they've been fighting the province on this for the better part of a year. And now they're coming back and saying, oh, well, maybe we have a solution. Maybe we can open up another lane for traffic. Well, the question is, why wasn't that thought of in the first place? Why didn't, you know, and to Rob's point about John Campbell's idea, why were these things dismissed in the first place? And I guess that's what troubles me. Now, in terms of the bike lanes themselves, one of the things I would probably ditch are the bollards that actually separate them. Painted lines on the road, in most cases, are sufficient. And, you know, the bollards also create another issue, notwithstanding the fact they take up more road space. When we were trying to remove snow after the big snowstorm, it's a lot more difficult to get those tiny front-end loaders in there to get that snow out. So they create a whole bunch of issues. But here's the problem city council also got into, which was everyone recognized that cycling is an important part of an integrated network with transit and motor vehicles. The problem is we got way too ahead of ourselves, or council did, in that part of that network is reliable transit, to Taylor's point earlier. And we don't have reliable transit. We don't have safe transit. So people are going to defer to their cars. And so we have to have a more balanced approach where things move sort of more in unison than this bike lanes on every street at all costs and everything else be damned.
Pat in Toronto wants in on the conversation. Pat, go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, Well, a number of issues. I live close to Eglinton, and we have bike lanes up there. If I have seen a dozen in the last year, I'd be lucky. And what that does, it takes Eglinton down to one lane each way. I live south of Eglinton, so we get a lot of traffic coming through. But there's another really dumb thing, and that is you go by any of these new buildings that are being talked about. So you have the big blue and white signs, and you'll see that they're going to be, you know, 1,000 bicycles and 200 cars at the place. Somebody is pulling the leg of the city, probably the developers, who don't want to put in car parking. So they are assuming that, or trying to suggest that everybody's going to be riding a bike. This is not Amsterdam.
Rob Davis, your thoughts there on that?
I couldn't agree with you more. And really, the developers are saving a ton of money. But in saving that money, I don't know that they're passing that on to consumers who are then going to buy these condos, or even transferring those funds over, you know, in what was traditionally called, you know, Section 37 money, so that the city can then actually provide bike infrastructure. It's kind of an odd thing for me to see, because normally the idea is that development, you know, growth pays for growth, and it seems odd that they're getting away with not having to provide any parking or very limited parking. The number of parking spaces, the standard for parking spaces for unit has gone way down. And yet, you know, the infrastructure for cycling isn't really there yet either. I think Councillor Burnside was right. Like, the city has gotten way ahead of itself. And a lot of people complain about, you know, snow removal mm-hmm. on bike lanes.
Yeah.
But there's a provincial regulation that requires the municipalities to clear the snow. So it's actually provincial law that after a certain amount of snow, they have to clear it. And there, you know, there are lawsuits related to road clearing of roads, the Highway Traffic Act and what have you. And when municipalities don't follow the standard, they get sued big time, and it could bankrupt a city if they yeah. don't clear those. If one person has a head trauma because they didn't clear that snow, it could cost us tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah, John reminded us of that, I think, when we were talking about it, when we had that snowstorm.
Yeah, it's important. If you're yeah. going to have the infrastructure, it's got to be safe.
Yeah.
But in the providing that infrastructure, we've now got this huge operating cost with very, very, very little utilization. And, you know, I used to, one of my ex-partner, I mean, she used to love cycling in the winter, and I would be panicked every single time she went out in that
yeah,
winter.
Of course. And I guess that it comes down to a philosophy too, Taylor. Like, what comes first, the cyclists or the bike lanes? Are we incentivizing people to take up cycling by building bike lanes, or do we wait for to see that there are a lot of cyclists traveling on certain roads and they deserve to have bike lanes?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, I think there's no question that if you add bike lanes, you're going to get more people cycling. The question is it worth it in certain parts of the city? Like in Etobicoke, maybe that demand just doesn't exist yet. You know, I'm willing to accept that. I'm a fan of bike lanes personally, but I also live in a part of town where a lot of people cycle. Yeah. It's a very common way to get around. And frankly, there's probably more people using the bike lanes than there are actually in the car lanes in some parts of the city. So I think it's really, you got to look at it holistically, and where does this make sense? Where does it maybe not make so much sense? That's really the way to judge these things.
And we'll go around the table one last time. There are a couple more topics I wanted to get to, but we didn't get there. Daly in Brampton, what would you like to add?
I would like to add, there's one way to reduce the traffic downtown. Reduce the traffic downtown. Raise Uber price and lower taxi price, and then you get some of those Uber off the road. Too many Ubers in the road.
Too many Ubers. There's a lot of concern around that. And it's not just Ubers. I mean, as part of that report that we were talking about at the beginning of our conversation, there has been a 26% increase in vehicle registration as well over the last 10 years or something like that. So just, and yet the road infrastructure has not been increased in that time. Councillor Burnside, final thoughts to you.
Well, final thought is the last thing I want to do with new developments is put in parking for the very reason that was just mentioned, which is we aren't able to increase road capacity. We need to force people that are now coming into the city to stay out of their cars. So if you don't put parking, you're not adding to gridlock, and you're forcing people to take other means of transportation.
Rob Davis.
Well, I'll take a contrarian point of view. If you don't put in bike lanes, then you have road capacity. I think the problem is council has taken away that supply of roads and then added 90,000 cars for hire almost instantly without providing any, at the same time with reducing the supply of road. And I think council has to revisit that. And I think you could integrate taxis with transit and bike share in a much better way. But there doesn't seem to be a way in which people get a discount taking a taxi after mm-hmm. they've gotten off a subway ride. And maybe if you did a little bit of that, you'd have fewer cars on the road.
Right. More incentivizing other ways to travel and commute. Taylor.
Okay. Well, tiebreaker. I'll take John's view on this. You know, we're a big city. We need to start relying more on transit, less on drive-in, start acting like a big city that we have become.
All right. Tune into the town panel. Thank you guys so much, especially, well, John, we always like to have you in whatever way you join us, but it was very nice of both Rob and Taylor to come into the studio. Thank you all.
My pleasure.
Thanks.
City Councilor John Burnside, Ward 16, Don Valley East, former City Councilor and Toronto mayoral candidate Rob Davis, and Taylor Scollon, co-founder of Zoomer Media Property, The Peak. It is Jane for Libby, and coming up in the second half of Fight Back, the extent to which Canadians are falling victim to fraud and how to make sure you're not one of them. And remember, the phone lines are open for your stories of falling victim to or avoiding fraud. 416-360-0740, 1-866-740-4740.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
Phone lines are already ringing. I know we either have been victims of fraud or we know people who have been victims of fraud. So phone lines are open, 416-360-0740, 1-866-744-740. We have some new numbers illustrating the extent to which Canadians are falling victim to fraud. A study by TransUnion shows that more than half of Canadians, 56%, say they were targeted by fraud in the second half of last year. Almost one in five, 17% of Canadians reported losing money due to fraud in the last year, with a median loss of just over $2,000. How is it? I mean, honestly, how is it that so many people are still falling victim to fraud and scams when we are also very aware that fraud and scams are a huge problem? Jeff Horncastle is a client and communications outreach officer at the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center. And Claudia Popa is with Data Risk Canada, cybersecurity expert and the founder of Knowledge Flow, a cyber safety foundation. Hello to you both.
Hi, Jane. Happy to be here.
And I'll start with you, Claudia. Sorry, I said Claudia, but it's Claudia. What about that? Why are so many people still falling victim to fraud?
You know what? It seems silly, but the fact is that fraud is not a static thing. It's been with us for hundreds of years, maybe even thousands. Certainly, it's been documented for the past few hundred years. I myself have gone into a retrospective of it in the Canadian Cyber Fraud Handbook, and the one constant is change. The fact is fraud, cyber fraud, any type of scams, adapt. They adapt to current events, they adapt to trends, and they adapt to the audience. So they change in order to take advantage of whatever people are most vulnerable to. And that's the quickest answer I can give you.
Jeff, what are your thoughts on that question? Why so many people still falling victim?
Yeah, no, I think Claudia, you nailed it. Fraud at the end of the day, I mean, it's, we all know that fraud is everywhere we go, whether, you know, we're looking at our cell phone, text messages, phone calls, social media, whether it's messages we're getting or ads on social media. We open up Google, do a search, the first 5 to 10 results appear are probably fraudulent, right? So like Claudia said, they're always finding new methods, and it's primarily technology driven. But at the end of the day, they're preying on vulnerabilities, whether it's financial hardship or big events in the world, whatever the case may be. They're adapting their methods.
And I think it speaks to, don't you think, Claudio, that people generally believe what they're told or what they're presented with. As human beings, our first instinct is to take whatever we're being presented with as truth.
That's right. We are creatures that are looking to connect with other humans, and we trust by default. We look for indicators of distrust, and if people write things with some authority, or they talk to us and they look us in the eye, we can't believe that they are likely to lie to us. A second factor here is the fact that we literally cannot be living in a bubble. We can't live in a vacuum. We can't avoid this stuff. So you can't say, well, I don't know anything about computers, so this is not going to affect me. Quite the contrary. You are a bigger target if you try to say that, hey, I'm technologically illiterate, so don't even talk to me about social media. The fact that you're trying to avoid this makes you a bigger target. And unfortunately, in many cases, seniors are targeted disproportionately.
I will get to the phone calls here in just a moment. So, Jeff, we have to basically fight our natural instinct and be skeptical of everything that is coming at us, primarily via technology or on the phone.
Absolutely. So the main thing is, like, I mean, at the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center, we document over 30 types of fraud. So, you know, you look at that and you say, well, how am I going to remember how all these types of fraud, like how they work? There's different methods. We have to remember that fraudsters always, there's always a sense of urgency with fraud. So fraudsters want you to react very quickly. The main thing is, remember that, you know, you always need to take the time to do your research, maybe ask a friend or a loved one, maybe contact the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center. Try to use as many resources as you can before making a decision, make an educated decision.
Yes. Let's go to Sheila in Mississauga. Sheila, do you have a personal story about fraud?
Yes, in a way. I haven't been, like, taken for a ride, but a long time ago, I had called this services, I guess, the fraud police or something, a number, and then they put that on my phone. So every time the phone rings, it'll tell you. If it's an authentic, the name will come. If it's a fraud, it'll tell me likely scam.
Yes.
So I do not answer the phone.
Yeah.
Now, I used to take care of a senior lady, older lady, and she didn't have this. And my God, how many people would phone in a day when nobody would phone? But, you know, because her being alone, she would answer thinking, oh, my son is calling, my daughter is calling, who don't have time to call. But that's what her initial reaction was, and she would answer and they would speak in the language that she spoke, because they knew who this person was.
They are professionals in a lot of ways, right, Claudio?
Absolutely. And I appreciate this example, because it matches exactly the methods that we are seeing out there, the methods that are being reported to the CAFC, the types of scenarios that we're seeing even on YouTube, where people are filming themselves answering the phone. And it's typically somebody who will do some cold reading initially. They will try to read you. They'll try to figure out what your age range is. They'll try to listen for an accent. They will dial your number based on your name and assume that you might be intimidated by the prospect of being called by a law enforcement or even by some border officer or immigration department, etc. So they will listen to you, and that's why it's so important to be able to screen your calls. That's a great piece of feedback. So thank you for that.
Yes, on my landline, Jeff, I also get those IDs of likely fraud. And that hasn't been going on for all that long. How did that come to be? Because that is very helpful.
Something that's offered by most cell phone service providers. It's an excellent feature, but what I want to point out is that it's not always 100% accurate. So, you know, in an instance where you get, let's say, a phone call and it says CRA and the CRA's phone number is on your call display, that feature may not pick that up. We have to remember that fraudsters can use caller ID spoofing, and they can alter the phone number that shows up on your call display. So I don't want to say that the feature is not good, but I just want to point out that it's not always 100% accurate, and it will not filter out all fraudulent phone calls.
Right, but the CRA, just to cement that in our minds, they get in touch with us really only by mail, right?
By mail or through your online account. You know, we always advise, you know, that was just an example. You know, it could be your financial institution's phone number showing up on your call display where sure. fraudsters may have your information from a breach, and they may know what bank you deal with, and they would have the ability to make that your bank's phone number show up on your call display.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, you always have to, if it even seems as legit as that, that's when you want to hang up and get in touch with your bank to find out if, in fact, that was real. Let's go to Rob in Toronto. Rob, you're on Fight Back. Go ahead.
Thank you, Jane, for taking my call. I'm just always in awe and amazed, really, how in today's age, there are still so many people that fall for these so-called professionals. I recently have been getting calls on my cell line, not even the landline, because I got rid of that. And I encourage, if you can, get rid of that landline. But they'll call and they're not even professional, honestly, Jane. You could read right through them. All you have to do is listen. But my point is, how can we still get so many seniors that are being hacked literally every day? Where is all the prevention here? Have we just done a bad job educating our seniors that it's become this terrible?
Yeah.
Like, I'm at a point right now where I'll listen to them and then I'll ask them, okay, so hold on. Do you need my credit card number or do you need my account number? And, you know, they go away so fast, Jane. They really do. You have to play them. You really have to play them. Not for a long time. Make it short and sweet. But I'm just amazed that how people are still being scammed.
Yeah, that's where we began the conversation, and I am with you. And thank you for calling, Rob from Toronto. With regards to staying on the phone with them and playing them, I mean, I know we're all different, but my philosophy is I don't even pick it up if it says likely fraud, and it does feel, Claudio, that you can determine that it's garbage within a few seconds, and you don't have to even engage with them, right? Just hang up.
Yes, as long as you retain control of that conversation. So that first measure of control is deciding whether or not to answer, right? So in order for any of us to be vulnerable to something, we'd have to be exposed to it. If we choose to answer, we are likely going to be more vulnerable to it than if we do not answer. So that's the first filter that you have to apply. If you do end up speaking with a stranger, and by the way, the CRA does make outgoing calls.
Okay.
And when you do talk to them, you need to say, look, I will call you back, give me your officer number. I'll call you back at the number that I trust. Don't give me the number to call. I will call the CRA and I'll ask for your officer number. It's the exact same thing for any incoming call. Anytime somebody is asking you for something and it's something unsolicited, you say, I don't recognize your organization, goodbye, or it sounds like you're calling from whatever, the police. Let me call the number that I trust and ask for you there.
Yeah.
That's one simple way that you can regain control and confidence over that interaction.
Excellent, straightforward advice. Crystal in North York, what's your story?
Good afternoon, Jane. My senior parents back in the day, it's got to be about 9 years ago. Now, this wasn't a telephone scam. This was somebody coming up to them, like, you know, people that come up and give you a hug and before you know it, your gold chain is gone.
Yeah.
my parents were sitting in front of their home on a sunny day, and this lady came up, well-dressed. Oh, you have a beautiful garden. Oh, your flowers are nice. Oh, what language do you speak? And then my mom said to her, we speak Greek. She knew a couple of words and threw my mom off, thinking, oh, okay. Then she went up to my mom and hugged her and pretended to talk to her. And she goes, oh, my God, your ring, this and this. And then she started talking to my mom about her engagement ring and another ring that she had on. And my father kept saying to her, don't give her any more, attention. Let her go. Let her go. But my mom, being the social butterfly, got sucked into it. And long story short, she confused my parents so bad. And somehow she ended up grabbing both my mom's rings, her engagement ring of 60 years gone, and a custom ring that my father had made her.
Wow.
And I called the police because my mom was really embarrassed. She called me after work. I went, and the police said, this is an ongoing problem. It happens every day.
Yeah. So you just, you don't know somebody and they're being overly friendly. Just get out of that situation. Crystal, thank you very much. We do need to wrap up because we are moving on to another segment. But Daryl, just very quickly, what would you like to add?
I remember hearing a while ago that if you even engage with them, or you know, you think you're going to play with them for a while and then blow them off, that you end up on other call lists, that they sell out. Yeah. So my system is, if it's not on my contact list that I can see who it is, let it go to voice message, and you can always call them back.
Okay, thank you for that. And we'll go to Jeff for final comments before we wrap up.
Yeah, you know what? That was excellent advice. You know what? If you don't recognize the phone number, you're always best not to answer it. And they'll leave a message if it's important. That way you can filter through the good and the bad. I do want to mention that there is a lot of stigma around being a victim to fraud. And we're trying to get around that. The reporting rate, we estimate that only 5 to 10% of victims report fraud. And part of it is, you know, phrases like, you know, oh, that's just a scam. Well, that brings away motivation from the victim to discuss what happened because they're embarrassed. So we're trying to get around that, and we have to remember that fraud can affect us in so many different ways beyond financial losses, and we have to be caring. And you know, if you feel like you're equipped with the tools necessary to protect yourself, share that information with your family members and your loved ones to protect them from being a victim.
This certainly won't be the last time we talk about fraud and cyber safety and security, but it's always a good reminder to have these conversations. Jeff and Claudia, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Jeff Horncastle is a client and communications outreach officer at the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center. Claudia Popa is a cybersecurity expert with Data Risk Canada and founder of Knowledge Flow, a cyber safety foundation. It is Jane for Libby, and we still have one more segment to go on Fight Back. An update to the provincial PC's plan to address the primary care shortage in Ontario. That's next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
Libby is off for a few days for Passover, and we'll be back on Tuesday. We're learning more about the Ontario PC's plan to build a system that automatically attaches people to a family doctor or nurse practitioner team based on their postal code. Health Minister Sylvia Jones is out today talking about how the province is looking for up to 80 new or expanded primary care teams to serve 300,000 patients. The minister says the province is launching a call for proposals today with $213 million attached to create or expand the 80 teams as part of a $1.8 billion announcement she made right before the provincial election. All of this is happening on the recommendation of former federal Liberal health minister Jane Philpott, the head of the Ford Tories Provincial Primary Care Action Team, who is helping the government connect all Ontarians to primary care by 2029. So this update is giving us an opportunity to find out how this plan is going so far. And of course, we always like to hear from you. Are you without a family doctor? And what is your plan to get a new one? 416-360-0740 or toll free 1-866-744-740. With reaction and to provide context, we're joined by the NDP health critic France Gelina and Dr. Iris Gorfinkel, family physician and founder of Prime Health Clinical Research. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
France, whether this is the right way to go or not no longer seems to be the question. Now it's about implementing the plan. So from a critical point of view, how is it going?
So I will start by saying that to move forward with interdisciplinary care is a good idea. This idea of, you know, we used to have a fee-for-service physician working by himself or herself, that's a thing of the past. Primary care, good quality primary care comes from a team. So this is something that we've been pushing for a long time, and we certainly support on the ground. How is it going? Not so well. Number one, not so well for that is that an interdisciplinary team certainly has physicians, but it also have nurse practitioners and social workers and dietitians and other care professional. None of them have seen a pay increase in the last 7 years. I have many nurse practitioner-led clinic that have reached out to me that are desperate for a little bit more money so they can keep the staff that they have, but the government is not interested in that and is not making investment. So if you cannot recruit and retain a team, we're back to square one.
As a family physician, Dr. Iris, do you like this idea? Are you planning to go down the path of working in a primary care team?
Well, the problem is this. You know, I'm established in my office now, so I'm an old dog. I've been in this office for 25 years, so it's really hard for me. And I represent what most family doctors are like. We run what amounts to small businesses. And the problem with the current thing. We definitely have to be moving into teams, but how we're going to take all these family doctors who, like me, have established leases, have ongoing expenses, have staff. Like, we can't just up and leave. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. But I agree. There's no way one doctor can do it all. The acute care, the preventive care, the cancer screenings, the immunizations. There's really a lot on that job description. And that's in addition to all the admin work.
So from the government point of view, the opposition's point of view, France, how do we get the Dr. Irises of the province to form these or become part of these primary care teams?
First, you talk to them and you listen to them and you respect the physicians that are there. I mean, we have a very, very good healthcare system in Ontario. Why? Because we have very good physicians who care for us in huge part, and other healthcare professional as well. So they have to be part of the solution. Listen to communities. I come from Northern Ontario. When I read that it will only apply if you have 8,000 people with the same postal code in order to be eligible, none of the community I represent have 8,000 people. Never mind 8,000 people who don't have a family physician.
Ah.
They don't have 8,000 people. You can look at Hearst or Cochrane or Espanola. It'll work around Toronto, and there are many, many people in and around Toronto who need access, so I'm happy for them. But she is the minister for the entire province. What about us? I live in Northern Ontario, and many, many, I don't have a family physician, and many other people don't.
Okay, let's go to Marvin in Toronto. Our listeners always want to get in on these important conversations, which are affecting everybody. Marvin, go ahead.
Hi, I can't understand where the problem is with people getting a doctor, because my husband went online. Within an hour, we had a doctor. Within 2 days, we saw a new family doctor. Within a two-month period, I had two MRIs and two ultrasounds. So, and I live in Jane, and Eglinton area. So I really can't understand where people are having such a problem.
Well, and I think that's what France was saying. And Dr. Iris, you would know firsthand, is this really a Toronto problem?
Well, thank you for sharing your experience, Marvin. The problem is you're not representative of what most people are experiencing. So I'm thrilled that you were able to get the services you need. But the projections are that one out of four of all Ontarians, that's 4.5 million people, will not have a family doctor by 2026. Oh, it's 2025 now. That's next year. So as you well know, the family doctor, the nurse practitioner, we are the entry points into the entire medical system. If somebody doesn't have access to a family doctor, they don't get any of the things I just listed. They don't get acute care. They don't get chronic care. And you know where they wind up? In the emergency room. Mm-hmm. They're more likely to be admitted, and they're more likely to die sooner from preventable causes like cancer.
France, I mean, Sylvia Jones, Jane Philpott, for that matter, and both of those individuals we reached out to, and they did not get back to us about being on Fight Back today. However, they're putting a good face on this whole thing. But, you know, Iris brings up the point that we're literally doubling the number of people who will be without a family physician next year. How realistic is the goal?
So they're aiming for 300,000 people that those clinics will be announced this summer. They will have a few years, months to get to the 300,000 people. But during that same period of time, over 1 million Ontarians will lose access to primary care, whether a nurse practitioner or a family physician. So yes, they are making little step kind of in the right direction that will help some people, depending on where you're located within Ontario. But it's not having an impact Ontario-wide, I can tell you, not in Northern Ontario, the rural community that I serve, as well as the numbers are very tiny. 300,000, this is wonderful for those 300,000 mm-hmm. Ontarian. That will be life-changing. But what about the 4 million other Ontarians?
Right. We have to leave it there. We're already at 1 o'clock, and we will continue to talk about this story and this issue as it applies to so many people in this province, a growing number of people in this province. France, Dr. Iris, thank you so much for your time.
Many thanks. You're welcome.
NDP health critic France Gélinas, Dr. Iris Gorfinkel, family physician and founder of Prime Health Clinical Research. And certainly, if I didn't get to your phone calls today, tomorrow is Free for All Friday. I encourage you to grab a line during the noon news. Coming up next here on Zoomer Radio, the number one's at one with Eva D. Jane for Libby. Until tomorrow, Jeremy in the news is next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.